Sorry about that, my friend.
It's okay. It's okay.
Okay, so I'll just do a brief introduction.
Okay.
We'll get right to it.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. So nice to see all of you on this beautiful, beautiful Juneteenth and Father's Day. I'm so happy that you could join us for our continuing series, After Incarceration, Bending the Moral Arc Toward Justice in the Season of Juneteenth. We were very fortunate to have Ian Jibril 2 weeks ago talked to us about the importance of education for those who are incarcerated and leaving incarceration. Last week, we spoke and learned from Kimmy Carlos, who talked about the importance of treating trauma caused by incarceration and the disparity of the impact of trauma on Black and brown communities in our state. And now, this week, we are blessed to have Anton Henshaw, who will talk with us about the importance of helping people find their way back to their community after incarceration. But first, let's pray. Gracious God, we give thanks for this beautiful day, this beautiful Juneteenth day, this Father's Day. We ask that you be with those who cannot enjoy this day because they are caught up in the incarceration industry in this state and throughout the country. We also ask for you to open our hearts and minds and open our eyes to see, our ears to hear, and our mouths to speak, to help those who are caught up, who are lost in the incarceration industry, so that we can help them find their way home. Amen.
Amen.
I first met Anton Henshaw virtually, so it was a real pleasure to meet him in person this morning on this beautiful day, and for him to come up and join us in from Camden, New Jersey, where he lives. We, on behalf of the Adult Education and the Mass Incarceration Task Force, I welcome you today on our third day in this season of Juneteenth, this third Sunday, where we have come to learn about issues surrounding mass incarceration and the impact it has on our communities. And Anton spoke with us at a mass incarceration virtual meeting, and Ann can back me up here. We had planned a whole agenda, and then Anton's story and message was so powerful, we just cleared the agenda, and we enjoyed our time with Anton. And Anton had just gotten a new dog at the time, and so you heard off-screen chomping of a big bone that Anton's dog had. And then last month, I was blessed to have the opportunity to see on Anton's Facebook page a very powerful conversation on violence, and I highly recommend it. It's posted on his Facebook page. I believe you have to scroll down on the Facebook page to May, around mid-May. Yes. And then, out of the blue, I just happened to be watching NJ Spotlight News one evening. They were talking about the new Justice Commission report that recommended juvenile justice reforms in building not three large juvenile prisons like we have now, but three smaller ones. And Anton was an expert to give an alternative opinion, saying, how about take that money and put it in our communities, help our youth so that they don't go to incarceration in the first place. And I'm sure Anton gave them a lot more than they cut down his response. but I was impressed that Anton is now a very powerful and voice for reform in the incarceration system in this state. And now that he has the attention of news programs that amplify these important issues in our state. And Anton Henshaw is Rutgers Camden School of Criminal Justice graduate school student. He's an executive director of CANDU, the Camden African Neighborhood Development Organization. He is a community organizer and founding member of the NJSTEP, New Jersey Scholarship and Transformative Education in Prison Program. We learned a little bit more about that and the power that that has from Ian 2 weeks ago. And Henshaw Anton has dedicated himself to eradicating mass incarceration and changing legislation to end the structural violence that disproportionately threatens the health of our black and brown communities. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Anton Henshaw.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me here. It is truly a blessing. Thank you for allowing me to bring my family. Also, your worship service was very overwhelming for me because this was the first time I've visited a church since I've been home, right? And the free gift message was just overwhelming for me. And it was like a confirmation of everything that we're doing. And for me to have my brother Russell, my fiance, Yashika here, and to be able to do the work that I'm doing, you know, it's not something like everybody say, oh, you're doing wonderful work. It's not me. It's really like what Russ used to counsel me while we were inside and minister to me. You know, he used to say, you know, when you're in your purpose, God is going to use you how he sees fit. And everything that I do, how I move, whatever I say, I don't come, if you ever watch me, I never come with a script. I never come with a speech. I'm truly moved by the Spirit. Whatever needs to be said, God will put in my heart and allow me to share and use me as a vessel. And I say that because today's sermon about the free gift and the message of love and forgiveness and redemption, I was always told that I was never worthy of this, right? And for a time in the beginning part of my life, I believed it. And I lived according to that belief. For those that don't know my story, I was incarcerated very young in 1988. I served 100% of a 30-year to life sentence, right? No breaks, no nothing. I never was in trouble before. I was sentenced to 30 to life. I was sentenced to die in prison. So my sentence was and still is a death by incarceration sentence. It's an enslavement sentence, right? And I didn't get to go to a juvenile facility. I went straight to an adult male facility, right? Do not pass go, do not collect $200. We're done with you. And in this place that I grew up in, I met some very beautiful people in the most darkest places that you could ever traversing the halls of Trenton State Prison. Oh. That's it. Traversing those halls, right? I remember when I first got there, the thinking in my mind was, how am I going to survive this? Right? All the survival skills that I learned in the streets that led me to this moment don't work. They're no use to me here. Now I have to learn. It's what we call code switching. I have to learn a whole new code. But I'm a kid, and I'm with adults. So you hear a lot of horror stories about prison and all of this stuff. I'm here to say it wasn't for me. I'm not saying it other people. For me, it wasn't the prisoners that were the threat to me. It was staff. The first time I was sexually propositioned was by a prison guard. Right? The person that was being paid by taxpayers to protect me and to protect the community was trying to sell me into prison prostitution. You can look this up. Their names is Officer Govan and Officer Stratford. Both of them been fired. And everything, this is what they were doing. But they weren't white, they were black, right? So when we're talking about structural violence, structural violence don't care what color you are, what socioeconomic background you come from. It cares that it consumes and it keeps consuming. And in that moment, I had to make up my mind, like what led me to prison, I'm in a position to make a choice. How are you now going to allow this moment to define you? I just failed in a previous moment. At the age of 13, people that I knew in my neighborhood paid somebody that I looked up to kill me. I'm 13 years old. I just turned 13, and there was an assassination attempt on my life because of the things that I was involved in, selling drugs and things like that. The adults paid an adult that I looked up to kill me. And he couldn't. That free gift that we were talking about earlier, that's why it always resonates with me, right? This guy was the number two welterweight in the world. And I looked up to him, even in his addiction. I never looked down on him. I would always help him, whatever I could do for him. And he knew that I loved him, even in his most lowest moments. And when it came time for the adults that paid him the money to kill me, he couldn't do it. That was the first manifestation in my life of the free gift. I didn't know it then, but I know it now. And as this man tried to lure me to a dark place to carry out, when I finally trust him enough to get back there, all I keep hearing is this man say, I can't do it, I can't do it. And I'm like, what do you can't do what? And then he told me the name of the people who paid him to kill me. And then he showed me the three guns that they gave him to kill me with. I'm a kid, I'm 5'4", 118 pounds. Why do you need three guns? I saw the drugs that they gave him, and I saw the money that they gave him. And just so fortunate for me that the kindness and love of that free gift of what I was extending to him, and he knew that I loved him and I cared about him. And when it came time in that critical moment for him to show that love and care for me, I stand before you today. Because he could have easily killed me, but he didn't. But those were the first time I ever had a gun. I bought the very three guns that were sent to kill me. Those were my first guns ever. And that set me on a mindset and a trajectory of, if I'm going to die in these streets, I'm gonna die with a gun in my hand. Had not that incident happened, who knows what I probably would have done with my life back then. But why am I saying this? I'm not saying this to justify any of my actions. I'm saying this to explain that we do not know what people are carrying when they make that final decision to cause harm. Right? No one ever asked me what happened to me. Everything was, what's wrong with you? Wrong question. For many years, I carried a lot of water that wasn't mine to carry, nor did I have the courage to put them down until I got incarcerated and met certain people in those carceral spaces. My prison father, Mr. Jerome Perkins. Without him, I probably wouldn't be half the person I am today. But he instilled in me education, right? Redemption, teaching me to love myself when I couldn't even begin to understand what love was. I'm still in the process of learning to love myself. But one of the biggest things is, how many people in this room still struggle with forgiving yourself? Right? You can love all you want. Right? We have that free gift. But teaching one how to forgive and how to receive forgiveness is a whole nother lesson. This is why I asked my brother, Dr. Russell Owens, to come today. Because he would always remind me that more people loved me and cared about me than those that descended. So we get to a carceral space in all of this mess, and we're trying to figure this out. One of the biggest things was we had to build community. You can't do it without community. None of this works without community, right? Politics aside, community is where we have to get back to. So we were able to build community inside. As you heard, I'm one of the founding members of an education program that has made monumental strides in our state, but you very seldom hear about it. It's very quiet, it's very deliberate. But the birth pangs was that when I met Ms. Virginia Kerr with our Lifers program. So it's all connected. It brings us all back full circle with that free gift. That she came in our most darkest times and teaching and sharing, because what we were doing, we were simply trying to help people get on level to get an education with the Lifers program, learning this for everyone, teaching adult literacy, prisoners, carceral citizens, teaching other carceral citizens how to get to the level to where you could get a basic education so you could begin to understand what is happening. All while we're trying to understand this monster called mass incarceration. So we have this big thing right now that's going on. It's a movement, and you all are a part of it. You all listening to social justice and different politics of different things that's going on. What I really want to share with you guys is the most important thing to all of this: people before profit. All the organizations want subject matter experts from Transformative Justice Initiative, an organization that we started when we came home. It was born inside the carceral space. They want us. They want us bad. They're willing to pay us $100,000 per just to add credibility to the profit before people paradigm. We refuse to do it. I'm not mad at my brothers and sisters that do it. The difference is that when you come around me, you know I'm gonna call it for what it is. So we have reentry, right? My personal view, and it will be displayed, reentry is a sham in America. Why do I say that? It's a continuation of the system of mass incarceration and the propertization of black and brown bodies. When I came home, myself and our executive director, Ibrahim Sudamani, wasn't no services for us. We wrote New Jersey Reentry Corps. We wrote a whole bunch of programs. But because we had life, no services. Nobody wrote us back. Our mail was considered jail mail. We don't answer jail mail. And then when we came out, we came to South Jersey. Most of the resources are North Jersey. So we began to travel up to North Jersey. But because we wasn't counted in their census, we could not receive services. These are examples of profit before people. We help whoever comes through the door at Transformative Justice Initiative. Just a little bit about what we do. We don't wait till people come home. We begin to engage before they are released. We've been inside, Russell's a little longer than me, 32 years, 30 years. Our crew averages a history of 30 years. As subject matter experts, what we do is each one of us has a different need. What Russ needed is not what I needed. We don't talk about homelessness to prison pipelines. We always talk about school to prison pipeline. We don't talk about poverty to prison pipeline, right? We don't talk about foster care to prison pipelines. We talk about what people put before us. And I'm sitting there saying, no. So when I begin to look at individuals as they're coming home, we're looking to see, what do you need? And then what we find out is most don't understand what they need until they get there. And by then it's too late. So then we develop a basic thing that we do, right? We do know they're gonna need clothes. We do know that they're gonna need an ID. Things that the DOC are supposed to provide by law are happening now against the law. So we do those things on our own. We connect with resources and build the network statewide. Returning Citizen Support Group, NOR Community Street Team, Patterson Hill and Collective, Guasabada Insights in Jersey City. We're all over. Trenton, Plaza Simpson, Learn to Earn. Burlington County, with Born Builders. Like, we're all over the state with our credible messaging network. In Camden, we're new entry opportunity specialists for Camden County. In Cumberland County, we're, living, I can't think of his name, but John Fuqua, I can't think of the name of his organization right now. But we built a network to, no matter where you come at in the state, we got you. One of the beautiful things about it is I was almost homeless when I came home. My sister was moving to Delaware and she was selling her house. I had $12,000 in the bank that I saved over my wages. I call them slave wages. The institution calls them inmate wages, right? So I had $12,000 in my Wells Fargo bank account, and I went to apply for an apartment. I got the money, and just so happens the place that I was trying to live, the lady that was the property manager, we went to elementary school together. She knew my story, so I didn't have to say that I was incarcerated or things like that. She said, we'll overlook that. She's like, Tone, but what we can overlook is that you don't have credit. I was locked up as a kid, never had credit. So how do you now, after 30 years and leaving as a child, and your application process get credit? Having no credit is worse than having bad credit. It means you don't exist. These are pop-up barriers to mass incarceration that nobody account for. No reentry organization can tell you any of these things that I'm telling you because they don't live it. So, all right, we got around not having, I just had got a credit card, but I hadn't activated it yet. So I was on a roll. She said, "Why? We can work with that." Well, where did you get this $12,000 from? I said, well, this is stuff that I saved that I knew I was gonna need in my first 90 days coming home. And this is what I earned while I was incarcerated. She's like, well, do you have a job? At the time, I just came home. I'm a graduate student full time, and I'm not working. I did public speaking as a means of taking care of myself, and everything was good, but they wouldn't allow me to use that as verifiable income. So I brought in what we call the inmate trust account statements from all the things that I had from in prison over the 30 years. And I laid the folder down with all my trust account statements, because I kept them. And I presented it to her. She said, those won't suffice. Here it is, I'm verifying what I saved and how much I left with, but it can't be used to get me an apartment. So when we talk about, you know, the homelessness to prison, or the prison to homelessness pipeline in reverse, what do we do? One of the biggest reasons people go back is because they don't have a stable place to live. The guys that we serve through Transformative Justice Initiative, before they come home, they got a job. But what's a job when you don't have a place to live? I can get you clothes and I can get you food. Where you gonna put it? You got the Fair Share Housing Act. It's almost like, you know, I don't knock the hard work, I even participated in it. It just put one layer before they can discriminate against you. That's all it did, right? So I can give you a provisional offer, and then after that, I do the background check or whatever the case may be, and then I can deny you legally. I have guys getting denied public housing, which is now illegal in the state of New Jersey, on the initial application. I send it to the people that's advocating for fair share housing, nothing. So I'm a solution guy. So what do we do? Right? As community, when do we come together, purchase property so they can lease from us, like the Reformed Church of Highland Park does, right? Pastor Seth Caperdale, Pastor Amos Cayley, wonderful work up North Jersey. When are we gonna duplicate it down here in the South, in Central Jersey, right? It's hard for me to get along because I'm still on parole for the rest of my life. I'm a slave to the state of New Jersey for the rest of my life. or until someone says otherwise. In order to go see my fiance when she lived in Atlanta, I have to get a slave pass in order to go. Slave pass is nothing more than a travel pass. Back in the day, prior to 1865, to go from one plantation to the next, you needed a pass, and it had to be signed. On the top of my, over, my name is first, what do you guys think is next on my pass to travel? Murderer. Murderer. So the traumatization of this whole process does not end when you leave the prison. It continues. The stigma. And this is a constant struggle and a constant fight every day. Reverend Dr. Russell Owens was told, you are not a regular citizen. Do not think that you are like anybody else. Here it is, this man has more education than the person that is monitoring him. He is an ordained minister. He has ministered to the lives of thousands of men. And yet, this person who was my former parole agent was still putting him in his place. They constantly tell us and reinforce that I'm not like you guys. I'm different. I like to exist in the space of different when it comes to being defiant, where I say good trouble. I'm the good kind of trouble now. I'm not the bad kind of trouble. So when I walk into spaces and we're bringing in clients to this very man's office, right, to meet their parole officers for the first time, and now they have to partner with TJI. But you said we weren't like everybody else. Well, why aren't we? Then he calls Ibrahim, our executive director, Ibrahim Sudamani's phone. I got a guy that needs services. Can you help him? You told Russ we weren't. But we watch how the spirit and that free gift move. Very quietly, very poignantly. We get to the point where the mental health aspect of our brothers and sisters that come home, to where if you look at Returning Citizens Support Group, they have a structure in the Conservancy in Newark where they sit down and they come and they have fellowship every Thursday night from 6 to 8:30. To where you could talk about what's going on, what's happening. So for me, I recognize that there's a lot of healing that has to take place, and we can't do it without everybody in this room and our communities in the state of New Jersey, right? So where's the redemption? Where's the reconciliation? Where's the jubilee when we come home? We're back from exile. We're back from isolation. That's where Meet Him at the Gate and Meet Her at the Gate comes. So we created an initiative called Meet Him at the Gate, where nobody comes home alone. And we go and we partner with all types of community, Fountain Baptist Church, Reformed Church of Highland Park, African Methodist Episcopal Church, and I'm hoping now Nassau Presbyterian. And that we're working on building coalitions to be able to address these issues. So when people are coming home, they have some safe place or safe haven or somewhere to go in fellowship and to do the work that we've been called to do. But Russ would say to me inside, he was like, I would get so upset. And he was like, Tone, that's not gonna happen until you get there, because we have to show them. And when he said that, it made me think of my grandmother, Lucille Henshaw. And she would always tell me as a kid, I was like, they don't listen to my brothers and sisters and my cousins. And she would say, show them first, then tell them. And then our writing professors would say, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them. So we, yes, we get to this point where fellowship, building community, love, right? And I'm gonna be honest with you, I'm very transparent in what I do and the way I move and everything that I say, right? I have to learn how to be loved by y'all, because I was in a place that didn't love me for 3 decades. And it's not just being loved, it's being able to trust that love. Because the love that was supposed to, or the safety that was supposed to exist, didn't exist for a lot of us for a lot of years. So when we come home, right, TJI becomes that bridge, Returning Citizens Support Group becomes that bridge to where we begin to validate each other's communities and say it's safe. I never enter a program or send any members that come through our doors to a program that we haven't already went through, that hasn't already been vetted. So we have a term called TJI certified. If it's certified, they know it's real. If they don't say TJI certified, don't mean it's not certified, it's just not certified by us. And when we begin to do this work, I began to watch the process of our citizenry coming back into the state, and they began to breathe. Short story. I just felt free for the first time. We have this saying amongst those that come home, when was your freedom moment? I was in Walmart in a toilet paper aisle. And I was watching, I'm looking at all the toilet paper. I didn't know that was that many toilet papers in the world. I've never seen that much tissue paper, ever. And I'm standing there confused. Why is that important? Well, in prison, they give you 4 rolls a month. You never have to buy toilet paper. So it was always provided for me. And when I came home, my family did the same thing. They provided toilet paper for me. They would make sure I had all of these things. And it wasn't that day I looked in the thing and there was no more toilet paper, so I said, I gotta go to the store and get toilet paper. And I was in Walmart and buying my own toilet paper, and it hit me. That was my aha moment. That was my freedom moment. It's not as glorious as some of the other people that'll tell you their story, but it's my story. And my point is, I share it, is that for each one of us is something different, where you take that breath and you realize, to the extent that I am free, that was my freedom moment. My realization that I am out here, I'm a contributing member to society, I'm a full-time graduate student, I have 2 full-time jobs, and we have our own company. But the beautiful thing is I'm in service of my community. I once harmed it, I'm here to heal it, I'm here to restore it, and I'm held to bring back redemption in any way I can. I'm not doing anything today that I wasn't doing inside. I've always been in service of my community. The difference is now is that it's in service and with fellowship. And it's a service to where she always gets on me. She calls me sweetness. You care about everybody else. You care about more than yourself. But what she doesn't know is that's part of my healing. Right, that's a part of my trauma. Right, it's a part of me trying to find forgiveness for myself by helping others. And she says, you gotta stop, you gotta slow down, you're gonna kill yourself. My answer to that has always been, they tried to kill me for 30 years and I'm here. But the difference is, I don't know how much time I have left. And I'd rather die on the field as a warrior, given everything I got, because I waited 30 years to come into play, not knowing if this was ever going to happen. I didn't know if this was going to be my reality, but I had faith and I prepared for it. She also says, I never told her. I would always say, when she would come see me and my family would come see me and my children, that I'm coming home. And I never knew how and when I was coming home. I just knew it was going to happen. And I operated in that space. When Russ got denied parole, it crushed me. It crushed me. Because I would always say, if not him, then who? If not Reverend Dr. Russell Owens, then who? And when they denied him, I remember sitting in my car crying, punching the seats, angry. And I'm like, I need him. I need him. And I remember being angry at the parole system. But I remember something he said. God gonna give it to you when you're ready for it. Not all the time when you think you need it. And when he came home, I was ready for it. Because the things that I learned in those 18 months made it a lot easier for when he came home. But if I'd have did it 18 months earlier, who knows where we'd be right now? Why is this important? It's important because we, as the body of Christ, determines through that free gift and that Holy Spirit how we're going to activate it in this world. I used to come and speak here at Princeton and thought it was the pinnacle of everything that I did, from life imprisonment to now I'm speaking at Princeton University. I once was impressed by that, but I knew God wasn't finished with me. There's way more things that he got for us to do. So when we're doing this, we got to do this together in a way to where that free gift is extended by proximity to the community that we built. Just touching. He said, I knew somebody touched me, right? I'm saying, just be by us and you're going to feel it. So when we come into rooms and we share, we just shared at a commission meeting in Newark last Thursday. They never had a group of returning citizens. We're trying to fix the language, so I'm catching myself. Testify about taking disparaging language in our state statutes and ordinances out of it. You'll see it come up. They just voted it out of committee, things like that. And I can't remember the commissioner's name, but he stood up. And he said, this is the first time in his 25 years chairing this commission that he heard people come in and testify to the pain of disparaging language that hurt us. And that hurts our community. And when he finally started unloading and unpacking what was happening in that room, where it was being in proximity to people who's been cast out that were willing to be transparent and share their pain, but also share in that victory and liberation and that forgiveness. One of the hardest things for our brothers and sisters coming home is to forgive ourselves. Where is that? Like Russ, about your second doctorate? So, and working on prison ministry and his second doctorate, right? He's going to be Dr. Reverend Russell Owens. That's just what we're going to call him. You know, we always got names for you. If you get a nickname from us, you're officially in. So, and I remember him and I talking during that last 18 months. And we were talking to Dr. Angelita Clifton from Fountain Baptist Church, And she kept asking me about prison ministry. And I said, I don't know anything about how to set up prison ministry, but I can connect you to Russell Owens. And then that started onto this new course of how do we minister to our captives in this system of mass incarceration. I want to segue into a whole, like a hard pivot. This is Juneteenth. Galveston, Texas. But I'm still a slave. Russell's still a slave. There's over 8,000 or 9,000 people still incarcerated that are slaves. That exception clause in our state constitution and in our federal constitution makes slavery legal. It didn't end it. I battle organizations about reparations. How can we ask for reparations for something that's not over? How can we do that? We can't. My good friend Ryan Haygood from New Jersey Institute of Social Justice, love him. We just disagree on his position. Do I support him? Yes, I do. As he, Mr. Marshall said, what I did was I still support everything that they do with the youth and coming to creating youth prisons and things like that. No, no more cages. If we continue to believe that cages are going to work, then we might as well say we believe in slavery. If you look at all the prisons throughout the country, if they don't remind you of plantations, I don't know what else will. Look at some of the names. There were former plantations, Parchment Farm, Angola, to name two. Right? And you look at the conditions of those places. Still chain gangs in Angola. Right? Sounds like a plantation to me. The difference. I don't have numbers on my arm like in the Holocaust. 217-853-4673826B is etched in my mind. I'll never forget those numbers. Why? Because to not remember and to be able to recall them at any given time, you were locked up into a smaller cell on the plantation. That hot box you see in Django and all of that, that's what they call solitary confinement. There have you believe we fought to end solitary confinement? Yeah, they did, but in implementation it still exists. So for me, it is how do we develop a harm reduction strategy for me to forget those numbers or for those numbers to not matter? I know those numbers better than I know my student ID number. I know those numbers better than I know my driver's license number. But it's that trick that your oppressors can get you to believe that I'm doing this, they punish me to protect all of you in your name. And then they say, we're gonna erect these big old walls so you can't see how I'm punishing them in your name. And then when you ask for accountability, now the unions come into play. Nah, we're not doing this. But I'm here to share on Juneteenth and Father's Day, right? I just started talking to my son. I don't have a relationship with two of my daughters. Pop-up barriers, remnants of mass incarceration. I saw my children more while I was in prison than I see them out here, and I'm on the street. How do we heal that? Harm reduction. And that's just me. When women are coming home, where's the services for them? They're the most underserved population, but that's where the babies come home to. So we did meet them at the gates for women, but I was doing a disservice. I was doing a disservice. I do not know how to buy what's a 5'6" or whatever, whatever those numbers are. I do not know how to shop for women. All right? I take mine with me, and she shops. Do you? I ain't got nothing to say. All I'm gonna say is yes. And when it comes time to put my credit card into the thing, I got you. But to do these things for women, I couldn't do it. And I recognized my limitations. Sister Cass Severe called her up. Can you handle, meet her at the gates for the women at Edna Mahan? We'll be there to support you, whatever you need, but I can't do it in a way that you know you have a lived and shared experience that I want to help you with. Counsel again, Russell, Dr. Russell Owens. So it's about part of meet them at the gate. And then she wanted to change the name for women to meet her at the gate. She won a first prize, which I told her she was gonna win because nobody does this kind of work. I said, and they're gonna do it. So she was at Seton Hall, she won. She won $5,000 to start, and then she won an additional $3,000, so she got $8,000, and then got another $5,000, which is $13,000 to start, just based on the presentation. How do we get here? Unconventional things, right? Free gift. That free gift just keeps everything we go, wherever we go, it just keeps expanding. Right, I came home, not a lot of money. I'm gonna close with this. Not a lot of money. But everything that I had, I poured back into my brothers and sisters that was incarcerated. And what I'm asking, right, for each one of us, how are we gonna use our free gift for those that are suffering from mass incarceration? How are we going to heal our communities? How are we going to be in service of each other? I know I can't heal without you, and the community can't heal without me. Can we do that right quick?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Would you like to answer a few questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Anton Henshaw. To find more information about Anton Henshaw, you can go to Transformative J
Initiative
on Facebook, and I think you'll like it. Really, really like it. And next week we have one more in our series of after incarceration. This one will be a special discussion from folks who are participating in Bend the Moral Arc series, discussion of race following the murder of George Floyd, inspired by that. It's been an ongoing program, and we look forward to hearing about their progress and their ongoing journey. Thank you very much.
No questions?
Yeah, if anybody has any questions, go ahead. We're just going to give people who have to get going. Absolutely. Okay. Going on their way. Yep.
How old were you when you were incarcerated?
I just turned 18. I was 3 months after my 18th birthday.
And how old were you when you got out?
48. Thank you. Anything y'all wanna?
You mentioned earlier, Anton, you said you've got some churches that are like partnering. So, and you said hopefully Nassau. So I have no authority to, make, but I'm just gonna ask a question. What is a way that you would like to see us participate more?
Well, we just partner with the, I know a lot of people don't understand, well, I'm not gonna assume anything. I'm gonna just say it. We just partner with Blue Pig Crypto, right? It's a cryptocurrency. It's on the Ethereum blockchain. So I partner with this particular company because they hire formerly incarcerated people to administer accounts. So, what I did was create a social impact bond, right, for our social justice network to be able to fund, to be independent, to where I'm not solely dependent on grants. That grant process is very hard. So what I did was we're partnering with who you all know, with one of our, I hope you do know, that's one of our professor inside, Chris Hedges. We're getting ready to partner with Chris to break out our social impact bond. And so what we're trying to do is reach a million people to contribute 10 cents to TJI. 10 cents. Doesn't sound like a lot, does it? It's not at all. But 10 cents from a million people sets us on a trajectory to be self-sustaining within a year. That's $100,000 to be able to stake, and it will create passive income through cryptocurrency for us to fund what we need to fund. The goal is to get 10 cent a month for a year after we get a million people to do it. Now, we can now expand nationally to be able to do this work. So we're currently with, what's their name in Georgia? I can't think of their name. It's a seminary college, and it's very famous, and I don't understand why my mind is blank. But to be able to build an avenue of self-sustainability to be able to do the things that we need to do to where we could, Emory University, right? So we work with Emory, we work with Swarthmore, we work with, it's like so many different universities to be able to do. I don't know why that slipped my mind, but we work with the Beloved Community Church with Pastor Toby Sanders. We're already connected. It's just now how do we access to be able to be self-sustaining in a way? And what we've done through, we got mathematicians and what we do, 10 cents. million people in 10 cents. And we're, you know, and to be able to fund that bond, to be able to take care of those things, to where we can keep people before profit.
Thank you, Anton Henshaw. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week, this time and place, 11:15.
Thank you all.